Howdy, folks. Hey, so I'm Preston Doster. I'm a board member of the Niven Lee Foundation. You only have to listen to me for like 30 more seconds. I'm just here to introduce Quintessence. I've had the pleasure of working with her for the last 4 or so years on both the Niven Lee Foundation and how we're working to help the open source community grow and Hackaderm. Y'all have probably heard of Hackaderm. We're a Mastodon community for queer folks and tech folks. And I think right now we're like the 13th or 14th largest instance. But you know, in that time, we've encountered a lot of things on the social web, a lot of good things, a lot of maybe not so good things. Quintessence has had the opportunity to do a lot of great research into new and emerging threats to our open source communities. And with that, I'll just let you take it away and talk about the data.
Hi, good afternoon. I am going to be talking about data. Preston is correct. But before we get started, I just want to do a quick check-in with everybody because the event is a bit chaotic, and just remind everyone to please have your water, your snacks, your meds, and your rest strategies on your person at all times. This is a very large and distributed ecosystem, and what an excellent time to practice what that means in real life. And with that, I'll just jump right in and get started. So before I get into the data, I will also be doing a quick level set on open source as an ecosystem, as not everyone has entered open source at the same time or been here the same number of years. And I want to make sure that we understand a little bit of the impetus for some of the things I'll be talking later, early on. And so when we talk about the launch of open source, it was launched quite a while ago, she says, with some nervousness. A few decades ago, and the entire landscape of what technology overall looked at that time was very different. So we see in the early 1990s, home computer ownership was incredibly rare, internet access was incredibly rare, tools were incredibly kludgy, and it was just kind of hard to get things done. Now, this doesn't mean that technologists didn't find a way to make that successful, but it does mean that the communication was difficult in different ways than it's difficult now, and things were slower and just didn't move at what we would consider to be a modern pace. We also understand that because it was a new movement, it wasn't running anything that we would probably call critical, at least not now. It wasn't running your healthcare, it wasn't running your national infrastructure, it was starting to run web servers, and people were not only getting grounded in the gist of the movement, but also the implications of what it might mean. When we move forward about two decades later, so 1990s to the 2010s, this had already started to shift pretty dramatically. So we went from having minimal home compute to some home compute. And instead of having internet access kind of nowhere, most homes did start to have it. And when we talk about whether or not there were shared devices and people doing lab access, yes, there was lab access, but again, there was also home access. And this is also when social media and social tools, as a consequence, started to both emerge and start to mature over the course of a decade. This also means that by this time, open source went from being a new movement to being about a 20 to 30 year movement, depending on your origin timestamp. This also means that it is running critical infrastructure by the 2010s. You're looking at things like it's running your healthcare and the other examples, government infrastructure, et cetera. This is where we start to see it really be important to everyone. And there's also the tooling barriers started to disappear. Tools became easier to use for everyone, not just technologists. And this means that the what is the risk-benefit analysis for any type of threat also shifted, because you did not have to have a persistent education or actor to have an amplified effect. And I will get into that in a minute. But of course, we're no longer in the 2010s, we're now in the 2020s. And now we have not only everyone has internet access, we have people with multiple devices, all with internet access that's kind of blanketing the globe. It's no longer a home wire, so to speak. And this means that you don't have things like the lab setup or even a single home shared computer as people used to have. You have all these chronically online devices where people can never truly turn things off. And this also has the effect of things being always online, including discussions in open source or activity or code or pull requests and et cetera, always being online. at this point, a lot of things are still true. Mature ecosystem is still true. The tooling barriers are even lower, and the value of open source is incredibly high. So over time, when I was looking at the supply side and demand side evaluation of open source, we have the supply side was being calculated as early as the early 2000s at a few billion dollars, and the supply staying peaked and kind of leveled out at around 4 to 5 billion estimated over the 2010s. But when we have the 2020s was when we had the first demand side valuation of open source, which was between $8 and $9 trillion. So this is a massive, massive industry that is being supported mostly by volunteer labor. And in fact, when we look at the rapid scale, we can see just how many code bases, and not just the code bases, but their components are being used that are in open source, 97% with 911 components per application. This is not something I don't think anyone would have been able to explain to people in the 1990s could be a consequence of a matured ecosystem at this pace. And when we talk about how people are contributing to open source, most technologists went from contributing to open source if they saw a project they fancied in the early aughts. Now everybody's contributing to open source as an entry into the tech industry, as an entry into open source specifically. And this means that open source has gone from a nascent movement to valuable, accessible, and critical everywhere. And this is very important to understand because I feel like we all feel like open source might be going through it right now. And some of you are laughing. Yeah, it feels like it's going through it. And so because I'm a data-driven human being, I thought to myself, I wonder what would happen if we tried to substantiate the feeling, the vibe, because you can't give a conference presentation on vibes, what the data seems to look like. And so I grabbed a pool of about 30 organizations in open source. These are open source foundations of a variety of sizes. And the idea was to take a decent cross-section of the open source ecosystem. And I want to say at the front a few important constraints and boundaries. One, I'm only sharing aggregate data. I will not be talking about individual projects or foundations, not even if you ask me after. I also am going to be talking about what I call a crisis event, which is scoped to mean a collapse or a near collapse event. This is something that causes the death of a project or its foundation, or a permanent schism in a project or its foundation, anything that is kind of a death knell to that ecosystem. And then all crises that I've researched, even though I won't be talking about the individual ones, are in the public domain. So even if you do manage to think, I think I know what this is about, you may, and you can probably Google it, and I still won't answer you. But because I'm not telling you who the foundations are, I am going to tell you the shape of what the foundations are. So it's roughly a 50-50 split of for-profit and nonprofit foundations with a slight skew into the nonprofit, and that shouldn't surprise. And I also balance them across t-shirt sizing between so-called extra small and extra large. The idea being that if you're a smaller foundation with maybe 1 to 2 staff, or maybe only an executive director and a board or something like that with a project to your name, you would probably be on the small side. And then an extra, extra large would be something with dozens or hundreds of projects as you ramp up from large to extra, extra large. Level setting across the founding ages was a little harder. There was a long tail for the first 25-ish years or so of open source for reasons, right? And then there was a surge in founding between roughly the years 2005 and 2015, which is in the lower two halves there of that graph. But there is still a decent spread of organizational ages in this data set as much as was possible. And now for the actual data. So in order to map this out, I plotted it in a histogram. So this is just the net number of collapse events in the 30 foundations that I cross-sectioned for open source. And just to be really clear, I didn't map crisis events and see which foundations had them. I picked the foundations first, and that will be relevant to understand that that's, while there may be bias in the system and academic rigor and all of that, the order of operations was understanding foundations first and crises second. The other thing to understand is that they do seem to have distinct types. There seem to be distinct events that cause a collapse or near collapse event. You can see one of them that's easy to codify as a licensing crisis. So a licensing crisis would be one of the corporations, for example, choosing to change the licensing of the open source and that may be causing some conflict with a community who felt like they gave their intellectual property under one understanding and having that understanding changed. But it is not the only type. In fact, the other four types are all human crises: codes of conduct, licensing, we skipped, governance, moderation, and leadership. So of the five primary crisis types that seem to emerge by category, four out of five of them are about people. And also, it's worth mentioning that basically every organization in the data set had a crisis event at least once, and many multiple. So this also means that regardless of size and age and et cetera, there was a near collapse event for that ecosystem for basically everybody. There's also something that we can understand when we see a pivot in the data like this. It means that the older foundations had more time before they had to deal with an existential crisis than the younger foundations. An older foundation basically had a whole founder's worth of career to stabilize, mature, expand, get resources, et cetera, before it had to deal with an existential event, whereas the younger foundations barely have their bylaws ink dry, and they are also having a crisis event. And if we compare by year founded, we can see that this is true consistently, basically having for the past couple of decades. The other thing I wanted to take a look at is we can see that despite there not being many crisis events capped at the year 2000, mostly for my ability to independently verify events, we don't see many collapse events, right? For a good few decades, pre-2000 included, until 2014. So we can see after 2014 and during 2014, we have a surge of events relative to the prior years and then continued surges after the fact. And since it's relevant to the talk, I know that people do like to talk about Rust and Nixos in particular often, usually due to moderation or steering committee or the things that people like to talk about. But the reason I'm bringing it up at all is while they are very similar, they're very large, they're very interesting, they are not unique. They are not unique even for the calendar year that people like to talk about. In fact, in combination, they are 2 of 9 events of that particular year. And we can tell that communities know that this is happening, whether they're articulating or not, because they start to respond by changing things in their ecosystem to adapt to this reality. And this means we're going to look at the 2010s a little more deeply as a decade of relevance. And first, I want us to understand a little bit about actor versus non-actor harms. And to understand actor harms, we're going to talk about what everybody talks about for a quick minute. So we have XCUtils, and when we look at XCUtils, the main thing to understand about XCUtils is that it was a sustained campaign over multiple years that weaponized the contributors' burnout and mental health. So if we want to talk about it in terms, we can say that the human state was the exploited vulnerability. This is not a code vulnerability, this is a human vulnerability, and a bottleneck in a way, because they were able to infiltrate the project and get to the only person that mattered to them, right? To have their objectives met, whatever they were. And this is an interesting discussion that I will be diving into after I explain this, because it talks about, we talk about trust and safety and security and human harms and so forth, but this is a very health-oriented, a very mental health-oriented thing that we need to be aware of. And it's also relevant when we talk about non-actor harms. Non-actor harms are the amplified effects of what happens when you have always online, incredibly interconnected spaces. So this is not an actor harm, but sometimes you can't tell the difference, right? You have a PR that blows up because the community is mad it hasn't been merged yet. And are people mad, or is someone fueling that fire to make them more mad? And they do look very similar on the surface, and neither requires technical sophistication. And the reason I want to bring this up, and I mentioned it in the beginning a bit long form, is the tooling barriers to entries have dropped very low. You do not have to have a lot of complexity in your tools or a lot of sophisticated understanding or even significant research and diligence to have the impact of a dedicated actor in the 2020s, right? Anyone can spin up a chat army, even if they don't know what they are doing or what to call it, because the tooling allows them to do this. And for all of these reasons, I want us to take separately, more deeper analysis and academic rigor and expanding the data set, because I think that we should take a look at some of the causes and vectors and amplifications that are happening therein. And so to quickly recap, we have about a 40-year-old ecosystem that grew from a small movement to a very large set of ecosystems, that we are participating in these earlier communities with the understanding that they were small and that that smallness had an artificial gate of a type. The tooling was hard, and so people really were only joining if they wanted to be there for the most part and if they could get past the tooling, right? And while all of that has improved, this means that everything is easier and some things are dual use, because modern tools have the effect that anyone can do kind of anything. We understand how to talk to each other. We understand how to connect to each other. We can commit PRs with actually not knowing how to write code as of right now with increasing relevance, right? Foundations are experiencing crisis events earlier and earlier, and this is spread across their age, their size, or their perceived importance, right? So it doesn't matter if you feel important or not. It doesn't matter if you feel big enough or not, or matured enough or not. You're kind of going to be going through it by definition. The volunteer teams, as such, don't know kind of what they're walking into sometimes, because in a lot of moderation circles, you have people who treat their ecosystems, the chat, the discords, the Zulips, and so forth, as if they are more closed than they are, just because of the cultural momentum of that mindset. And when they encounter things that they don't understand, they may or may not have the language or tools to tell leadership what is happening or why it's happening or why they're taking the actions they feel they should be taking. And these communication breakdowns can and have become very public. And all of this leads to people having more difficult early detection, because if you don't know how to articulate what you're looking for, you very likely also don't know how to map it out, how to look for a signal misalignment, what signals even should be aligned or misaligned for you to do continued research or for you to do over time research, because again, you're not usually distinguishing in the moment if somebody is being authentic with you or not. You're looking at behavioral patterns over time, which means you need to have enough data, enough granular data to be able to do that. And all of this feeds into how do we keep our open source communities open? Because if we understand that all these chat toolings are having these amplified effects, it can start to make people feel like we need to shut it down somehow or close it down or do something very reactive in order to protect ourselves. And while it is true that we need to change our mindset some, we can protect it without being quite so drastic, just by improving our understanding of the situation and acknowledging a changed reality that we find ourselves in. One of these is to, again, acknowledge, but also analyze and address what that means. So we build over time what we think we need to see. If we encounter an event that we did not have adequate data to do a postmortem on, even if it's internal only, we know we need to increase the type. We know we need to increase the type of data that we are gathering and apply that future forward so that we can analyze over time. And the only way that we can do that is if we start to address things differently, again, over time, so that we stop engaging with potentially inauthentic conflicts as if they are authentic every time. One way that we can look at this is to look at our contributor ladders. These are a concept that are pretty familiar, I believe, in open source communities in general. Most people associate them with code, though. You get your first privilege, you get your first ability to commit, you can merge PRs or you can't, you need to escalate or you don't. But contributor ladders are also useful for other reasons. We can apply organizational threat awareness to the contributor ladder. As you grow in maturity and understanding of a project and or its foundation, again, depending on size and scope, you should have an organizational threat model and be able to apply it more and more and more as you become more senior. Effectively, what I'm proposing is as you grow in the technical admin and you move up the ladder, you grow in threat awareness and the defense of that threat. You're not just aware that something could be happening. You're aware of what to do about it. And every time you move up the ladder, that means that people will start coming to you, level appropriate, to help resolve things that they don't understand and they don't need to know how to articulate. We also need to start writing things down better, even if we don't know how to gather the signals yet. And we need to write it down as consistently as possible so that if we realize that we don't have the granularity of the data we need, we can search through it and try again. We understand where the gaps are that we've missed, and we try again. We understand that organizational memory and churn is a risk in organizations that don't have documentation. And I don't just mean onboarding documentation. If you have a moderator or moderator's team that has a lot of churn because of burnout, somehow the people who step in need to acquire this threat awareness and the social awareness of the ecosystem they've just walked into, because organizational amnesia is its own kind of risk. If people don't know what to do and nothing's written down and they don't know how to frame it, every time there's a turnover, that situation will repeat. And all of this also points to the fact that anything can be weaponized in social spaces. And this is especially true if the cost to the attacker is low and the burden on the target is high. We see this with fraudulent requests, like fraudulent GDPR requests and so forth, where your burden to respond as a project organization is high by definition, but it is very low energy to just spam those out, right? And this all matters because having these pivots also means that we can have our moderation teams know how to distinguish, and as part of that discernment, learn to help protect the mental health of their communities as a strategy for protecting those communities. This is also true for mentors. When moderators and mentors and more senior people in the ecosystem introduce responsible friction into the system, they are protecting the burnout level of their contributor pools in a healthy way and making it harder to move too quickly through the ecosystem. We can help this by normalizing conflict in our ecosystem, because if we're so conflict averse we don't know how to have a disagreement without it blowing up, that blow up is also an attack vector. So by having a healthier, more grounded community, we both have a more thriving ecosystem and can defend better and inoculate better against that type of exploitation. It's also important that moderator teams understand that moderation is about boundaries, not punishment. A moderation team can stall out if they think about moderation as punishment, because if they do, they need to know if the person means it, if they intend it, if they're a threat or not, or an actor or not, and you're not going to know that. You're just going to need to know if you have a boundary that's been violated that you need to defend in some way. And really quickly, I would like to remind everyone to thank your moderators and all of your teams. And this isn't just for online social media, although please also thank your Fediverse and so forth moderators as well, but also your contributor ecosystems for GitHub, because all those spaces, all those social code spaces have moderators. Moving back into it, when the moderators ask themselves, is this behavior compatible with community health? That is how you know you need to take an action of some kind. And that is how you avoid the stall out of trying to figure out if something that will only be revealed over months or years is a different shape of problem than you think. There's also a parallel to responsible friction and moderation. In code bases, you don't want someone to take on 50 projects at once and contribute hundreds of PRs at once just because they're really excited and burn themselves out. But in moderation spaces, you also need to help steward this healthy, balanced reality. And it's the moderators who act more like social workers for the community and they need the equipment they're in to be able to respond to these types of spaces. It's not just fellow technologists who are tech-oriented who should be moderators. It's also people who understand the socialization between people and how to help them remain connected who would need to be stewards of community in this way. And so before I just go to the last slide here, moderation teams, you need to approach your situations without judgment, which is really hard, especially when you're not sure what's going on or someone's on their second, third, or fourth incident, again, depending on your code of conduct and how that's outlined. And it can be very hard to not feel like you want to judge a situation or an individual in that situation. But in order to be able to do this, in order to frame moderation as boundary protection and not punishment, you do need to make sure you're proceeding without judgment. And with that all said, I just wanted to make a nice recapable slide. We need to have organizational threat awareness. This is true for foundations or for projects that are sufficiently large that they have their own ecosystem around them. And we need to center the healthy development of our maintainers. And this is both for their benefit and for community inoculation benefit. We need to normalize conflict so that people can disagree without it becoming amplified and it doesn't become its own exploit. And we need to understand and address the nature of protective measures that may themselves also become weaponized. This doesn't mean we can't do anything. It just means that we need to be aware so we can proceed thoughtfully. We also have to have standardized documentation for social risk and not just code. It's not only about the code. If we understand that vulnerabilities can be human, for example, again, XEUtils, we know that the human was the exploit, not the code, although eventually it was used to make a code that was an exploit, right? And this means that everybody needs to work together. The security specialists are the ones who understand and can do risk analysis, threat modeling, abusability testing, and build the guidance that everybody else can use and act on. And since we're running a little slight on time, I'm just going to go right to the point. So as I look through all the data, and I have been trying to pivot and help people understand the guidance, I've spun up a working group. Because when you notice that there's a problem, we don't solve that out on our own. We work with others. And in this case, we have a working group about securing open source communities. And the idea is to have some researchers in the space, some social workers in the space, and then a bunch of foundations or leadership or moderators in the space talking together about the problems and therefore the patterns in those problems so that we can solve them together and build the guidance that does not currently exist. Phase one of two is going to be the communication standards. This is how we can get everybody used to talking to each other in a way that they don't compromise information just by sharing that information for collective benefit. And then we are going to use that skill to do the threat modeling and abusability testing of codes of conduct, governance models, and so forth to produce guidance on what to do next. We do have a session right after this talk. We're going to be in Building F somewhere that I can find. The existing group will be being there. If you want to ask me questions, you can also find us there. And with that, I thank you all for your time. Feel free to come to our Birds of a Feather tomorrow morning.